Shrink Wrap Radio number 304, Tragic Beauty, The Dark Side of Venus Aphrodite with Jungian analyst Arlene Diane Landau.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Jungian analyst Arlene Diane Landau, and we'll be discussing her new book, Tragic Beauty, which explores the dark side of the Venus Aphrodite archetype. Arlene Diane Landau, Ph.D., is a diplomate senior Jungian analyst. She's a member of the C.G. Jung Institute of Los Angeles and the Interregional Society of Jungian Analysts and the International Association for Analytical Psychology. Dr. Landau has been a certified Jungian analyst for 16 years and a psychotherapist for 25 years. As a mythology scholar, she's provided an archetypal analysis of the novels of Thomas Hardy. Dr. Landau holds a bachelor's degree in fine art, master's degrees in psychology and mythological studies, and a Ph.D. in mythological studies. She's lectured in Berlin, Bucharest, Cape Town, London, and in the United States. She's a board member of the Archive for Research in Archetypal Symbolism. Dr. Landau has been active in the teaching, analysis, and evaluation of candidates in training to become Jungian analysts. Her interests include art, literature, theater, and film, and she is in private practice in Pacific Palisades, California. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Arlene Diane Landau, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dave.
You've written a very slim but compelling book titled Tragic Beauty, The Dark Side of Venus Aphrodite and the Loss and Regeneration of the Soul. That full title is quite a mouthful. Well, before we get into your book, as I was reading more of it last night, I realized that we grew up in somewhat overlapping worlds, and I suspect eras. You grew up in Beverly Hills, and for a year or so, I grew up on just north of the Sunset Strip. And I know you had parts on the Ozzie and Harriet show. And for a while, I went to Bancroft Junior High in Hollywood, and Ozzie and Harriet's son, Ricky Nelson, was in my class, and his brother David was 1 year ahead, although I never got to know either of them as friends. So there's a little overlap there, isn't there?
Yeah, and actually where my parents lived was north of Sunset, off of Benedict Canyon.
Okay. Right. So I know that area. I grew up in that area. I have a sister who worked in the movie industry for a while. So there were lots of aspects of your book that really resonated for me. What led you to write this book?
Really, what led me was a conference about 10 years ago called Myths in Hollywood, or Myths in L.A., that actually my husband organized. His name's Brad Topaski, and he's also a Jungian analyst.
Uh-huh.
And it was a big conference of a number of analysts. One was, I saw that he was on your show, John Beebe.
Yes, yes.
The drummer from The Doors, John Densmore, and some mythologists. And so due to this conference, I sort of dredged up all this material from my past and what led me to finally become a Jungian analyst.
And a delightful dredging up it is, and Hollywood and Beverly Hills, as you kind of point out, and Los Angeles in general, sort of a mythic place to begin with. Part of there's this whole sort of worldwide attraction and fantasy about what all that means and what it represents.
Yeah, it's true. I particularly remember as a young girl in Hollywood working as an actress, an extra, and a dancer, going to, I can't remember the name of it, the Hollywood Club or something, where girls from little towns all over the United States would come, and they would, like, it was like a rooming house with actually a matron living there to watch over them, would be living there to try to get parts in Hollywood. And I often worked with these girls, and they often had a much more tragic fate than I did because they weren't psychologically prepared at all for the, as you said, mythic city.
Yeah, and I gather there's something, I imagine that still goes on, and there's a parallel thing that goes on with models, I gather, that there are these sort of houses that models land in that have sort of a house mother and in major cities around the world, fashion cities.
Yeah, they find them often in, you know, the Ukraine or some obscure places where these find these girls. They're, some of them are so beautiful. I was in the Ukraine and saw some of them. They're almost like creatures. You know, they're so unusual looking.
Mm. Perhaps we should begin by having you take us through the Aphrodite myth, or perhaps I should say the Aphrodite myths.
Okay, well, one of the main ones is she, you know, was sprung from the foam of the sea. And the Greek word aphros means sea foam. And in Hesiod, she is born from the severed testicles and foam of the sea after Cronos has castrated his father. And so that's like when you see the painting by Botticelli where she's standing, you know, in a seashell.
Oh, yes.
A very famous painting. And then often she is supposed to have sprung even from a clam. And if you think of her moistness, having been in a clam for so long.
You know, the fact that that the Greek word for foam is involved there and the idea that she sprang from the foam, it's almost suggestive of the ethereal, unreal, ungraspable aspect of Aphrodite.
Yeah, that's really a very profound comment. We, at the Getty Villa in Malibu, there's an amazing Aphrodite show now, and it was in Boston, and it's the largest collection of ancient sculptures ever assembled in the world in one place. And one of the most stunning ones is she's lying down, and you see her beautiful buttocks, and then one walks around to the other side, and she has testicles.
Oh, my goodness.
And it just shows how she contains the all.
Mm-hmm. So what are the qualities traditionally associated with the Aphrodite archetype beyond beauty and allure? Those are two that you really underscore, but there's a bit more.
But just really the main thing, because what I write about is not so much the ancient goddess, but how she shows up in modern day women and how, you know, actually painful it can be. But often these women are just extremely glittery. And when my husband and I are at an airport or something, we say there's one of the species, like a particular type of bird.
Yeah.
And you can just, you know, see them in, you know, every supermarket and some places, for instance, Russia, for whatever reason, they're just everywhere. And maybe due to all the former oppression, but they're the ones with the rhinestone belts and the, you know, glittering barrettes. And like in Russia, I would see them walking home from already working at two jobs, often supporting their husbands, with 6-inch heels in the snow. Comfort is not the issue.
Yeah.
Or even at the airport in Russia, the ones that, you know, check to see if there's anything dangerous in one's bag, they're all day in these 5-6-inch heels, and they're, you know, streaked hair and very low cut and like leopard shoes and just very, very over the top.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to observe this kind of woman, this species of woman in our contemporary life, and to think of this as a manifestation of an archetype. I mean, it's really kind of a new way of thinking for me. I've not gone through the world looking for living archetypes in that way, but it's very compelling.
Yeah, and also some other Jungians have written about this in a little different way, but primarily Jean Bolin.
Yes.
Broke down some of the archetypes, you know, and how people are living them out now.
Right. And as I read your book, I found it was triggering a lot of reflection about my own past loves, issues, and psyche. So I think this is very much a book for men as well as women. Would you agree?
Absolutely, yeah. How did it trigger that in you, or what?
Well, you know, I'm going to say more about that along the line here, maybe towards the end. I've kind of got our conversation mapped out a bit. So okay. I don't want to evade that question, but I want to come back to it. When you talked about the Aphrodite archetype and the way it manifests in contemporary women, you refer to her as, and I love this phrase, the it girl. Tell us a bit more about that, the it girl.
Maybe I can read a tiny bit.
Oh, sure. That would be wonderful.
This says it pretty well. Several years ago, I was in the Gallery Lafayette in Berlin on the third floor in the hip younger section. There she was again. She was tall and slim with long black hair slicked back in a tight, high ponytail. She wore a short cropped white rabbit jacket in a baseball style and an electric blue top under the fluffy jacket with matching electric blue pointed silhouette heels. She wore very tight white stretch jeans. She carried a very small purse encrusted with fake stones. She was introverted and private. I watched her every move, knowing that she was the one of the species. There are not so many of them in Berlin as in Beverly Hills or Manhattan. She finally made her purchase, which was a metallic belt studded with colorful stones. She was already wearing a similar belt studded with clear rhinestones. She walked out of the department store and down the escalator, and all the male department store workers had their eyes on her. Anyway, so that's an example. So it's like wherever one goes, or if it's a party, you know, she walks in and all eyes are turned toward her. And other women or girls may be even more beautiful, but she just has this quality. And I think somewhere in the book I talk a little bit about Paris Hilton. You know, she's not as popular right now. Just had that or has that sparkle.
Right, the it girl, the girl of the moment, the girl that everybody's got their eyes on, whether it's in the macro or the micro, whether you're at a party or you're looking on the world stage at somebody like Paris Hilton, or you also talked about Princess Di in that context as well. And one of the things that you point out is that the it girl is not a sticker in terms of relationships. She's always looking for the next one, the idealized lover, which is kind of ironic. I mean, she herself is kind of the idealized sex object for males, and yet she's looking somewhere else in the distance.
Yeah, yes, this is true. And it's, of course, in her ancient mythology. So, you know, as you know, she was married to Hephaestus, the lame god of the forge, who was supposed to be quite actually ugly. And then in the myth, she's making love with Ares, the god of war. And Hephaestus wove a very fine net and put it over them and captured them. So she's always looking for someone else, or Helen and Helen of Troy, starting the whole Trojan War. And she just absolutely can't stick. And like, I have a patient of that ilk now, and every week she comes in, you know, with a new story of someone she's madly in love with, and he's the best one, and no one was ever like this one. And it just goes on and on, really, until old age. And then often they end up alone and rather bitter and dried up.
Yeah, and you say strikingly, though, that the Aphrodite allure sometimes manifests in older women and not just younger ones.
No, yeah, it can stay alive. It doesn't, like, for the older women, it wouldn't be one where it manifested if she wasn't already an Aphrodite type. But she can keep manifesting it, you know, on and on and on and on. Some do, and others, you know, like Elizabeth Taylor, for instance, who was certainly, I think, an Aphrodite type, and then she ended up never leaving the house as she got old. But others, you know, just keep going. It's remarkable.
Yeah, I remember there are a couple of women that come to mind in my past who I was tempted to come on to. There was a substantial age difference, and so I felt a little funny, and I wasn't sure if I was supposed to come on to them or not. And
So they could have been even 20 years older than you, I bet.
Yeah, yeah. And but also I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure how wide that age gap was because they had that kind of, there was some kind of sexuality. And not that they were overtly in the couple of women that I'm thinking of, it's not that they were flaunting it in any particular way. It was more like there was an inner essence of some sort that seemed to call out in that way.
Yeah, that's it exactly. And I remember when I was visiting my daughter when she lived in London for a while, and some of her male friends said, you know, about me that I was, you know, the type of mother that you go to bed with.
Oh, that's pretty overt.
They said it not so politely, but.
Yeah, I'm aware that there's a term out there for that. Yeah, you also described in relation to your daughter that you were aware you were out in the world with her and that you were aware that men were looking at her but not at you and that they used to look at you, but now that had somehow kind of passed on.
Yes, yes, this is certainly true. And to, you know, give the younger ones their turn, and of course, whether you give it or not, it happens.
Right. And so the challenge as the parent is to be able to have the flexibility and the grace to recognize this shift and to somehow flow with it and be okay with it, even as you're aware of it and maybe a little bit nostalgic. I had a real taste of that myself, I have to tell you. I have a son. I don't know what the counterpart, the male counterpart for Aphrodite is, but he's tall and handsome and charismatic, and he had to, early on, he left the little suburban burg that he grew up in here where I still am, and he had to go to Manhattan. He wanted to live in Manhattan. I said, why do you need to go to Manhattan? And he was going to start off by being a busboy in a restaurant. That's how he was going to make his way. And he said, well, I want to make connections. And I half jokingly said, you know, I'll make important contacts. And I half jokingly said, and so what kind of contacts does a busboy need?
oh, that's great.
Yeah, but he went, and in fact, it's turned out quite wonderfully for him. And so I went to visit him in New York, and he's a faster walker than I am. So I was trailing a little bit behind him as we're walking quickly down the streets of sidewalks of New York. And I'm watching these young girls, their heads are just snapping like on a swivel as soon as he's walked by. And because I'm in the wake, I'm seeing it. He's not aware of it, but I'm watching this happen as I'm walking behind him. And I had that same pang of, you know, of feeling not seen and remembering a time when I used to be seen, but hopefully accepting it with some grace.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting what you said. So the counterpart of an Aphrodite type can be a Dionysus archetype.
Okay.
You know, as you know, the god of wine and orgies and beauty. And often Dionysus types and Aphrodite types can hook up. But it's that, you know, as you described your son, I could just, you know, had my own vision. You know, this beautiful man. And also, if he's the Dionysus type, I mean, he's not probably not going to be an engineer or, you know, a mathematician. Mm-hmm. He more likely maybe is an entertainment or, you know, something more alluring.
Yeah, yeah. You point out that the challenge for the Aphrodite woman is to become conscious. And so, of course, that raises the question, conscious of what? In particular, what is this expanded consciousness? What does it bring in?
Yeah, that's a very good, very, very good question. I'll just start slightly by, which is in the book a little bit, talking about the story of Snow White. In fact, there was a magnificent French-Canadian ballet of Snow White in L.A. just 2 weeks ago. Mm. So, you know, as we all know, you know, she has the hunter kill Snow White, or, you know, he kills a deer instead because he has compassion. And she's going to eat Snow White's heart, but instead it's the heart of a deer. And in the end of this particular version, the dwarfs who work in the, I guess it's the coal mine, tie coal to her feet so she dances herself to death by the hot coals burning up her feet and dancing wildly on stage. So the consciousness is really being aware. I mean, it took me years of analysis and, you know, as you know, to be a Jungian analyst, it takes about 7 years postdoc or post licensing in the state of California. About 7 years, and during all that time, one has to be in analysis with a certified Jungian analyst. And in order to get into training, one already has to have, I believe it's 100 hours with a certified analyst to even begin. So all of that, the first step in any analysis is learning to be conscious of one's shadow. So like when your son and you said, you know, I like how you said the heads were swiveling.
Yes.
As the girls looking at him. And so, you know, you were conscious of that and, you know, probably could think of your own mortality or, you know, even, you know, maybe sadness of being older. And
sure.
And you know, and even, you know, for me, you know, feeling sometimes jealousy or the dark side and writing about it, that's a big Jungian technique to, you know, journal and write about,
right.
You know, you're laughing.
Yeah.
Writing about just being conscious of our shadow and our darkness. And, you know, the part that mirror on the wall always wants to be the fairest of all. And really owning that, it doesn't make it go away, but at least prevents one from acting out continually.
Yeah, you point out that Aphrodite's qualities of beauty and allure are but one side of the feminine, and the challenge is to integrate the other qualities of the feminine. And in that context, you mention other female goddesses or archetypes that need to be called upon or integrated. And I think you mentioned Hera and Hestia, Athena, Artemis, and finally Sophia. Mm-hmm. What are the feminine qualities associated with each of these?
Let's see, I'll just start, you know, and again, it's how we see them in our everyday lives is, you know, my focus.
Yes.
But, for instance, Artemis is quite easy, to pick out and just like go to any lecture, any college class, and she's the one, wearing the Birkenstocks or the jogging shoes. I could almost say never will be wearing, you know, the 4-inch strappy heels, and she's, you know, wearing a flannel shirt and jeans and, you know, no makeup. And, maybe at 30, she's already, you know, pretty tan and wrinkly from so much sun. And she's the one typically, if you go into a park, and she'll be there at the booth, you know, taking the money as a park ranger. And
this is great. You paint such a picture. You know, and I'm seeing her. I've you know, having taught at the university for so many years, I think I've had a chance to see all these different types. go, keep going.
Oh, thank you. And so she, like, she'll be, you know, in the zoo, at the zoo, you know, mucking up the cages. And, you know, often she might marry, but often she doesn't. She often doesn't have children. She, you know, might be lesbian, not necessarily. But, you know, you just look around and, you know, as an older woman, she'll have the short gray hair and almost dressed in men's clothing, and, you know, an Aphrodite type might say, you know, why does she do something with her hair? how can it be that way?
But what's the strength of Artemis then? What's the good quality that maybe the Aphrodite should think about integrating into her own personality?
Yeah, very good question. Well, she is one and two herself, so she... can go out in the woods and, you know, build a campfire maybe, or, you know, put up her tent, and very, very self-reliant, you know, not so scared, not, you know, certainly not worried about who's admiring her, not spending money on clothes all the time and shoes. But she's really one unto herself and her sisters.
Yeah. What about Hera? Yeah. What does she bring to the party, so to speak?
So,
maybe she wouldn't even be at the party.
No, she would be, actually. And sometimes Hera's can look a little Aphrodite-ish, but she's the wife. And no matter what, and I think I talk about in the book, Hillary Clinton is an example. No matter what, I mean, she's also very Athena-like, but they stay married. They very, you know, maybe they'll have one divorce, then the next marriage will, you know, be another 50 years or something. But she's the wife, and her life really revolves around the husband. And often, she can, you know, be pretty interested in fashion, and she actually is the one in mythology that Aphrodite lent her golden girdle to Hera in order to attract Zeus, who, of course, was the husband of Hera. So they're often like the power couple, like, again, Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton.
What about Hestia?
So Hestia, very little is written about her because she never leaves the house. And so she's the goddess of the hearth. So she's very, you know, very introverted. She stays home. Often, she often may not be married and will be, let's say, the daughter who takes care of the aging parents. And sometimes in movies, you'll see her with the aging parents, and she'll have all these keys hanging from her belt for the different cupboards of her taking care of the home. And she's just, you know, there's no commotion about her. She doesn't cause trouble and you know, is just happy, wants to be at home.
Oh, I was just going to say, I'm thinking of Downton Abbey, if you've watched that series at all.
I love it, yeah.
Yeah, I'm thinking of, you know, maybe one of the head housekeeper with all the keys, is kind of keeping everybody in line.
Yeah, and she never marries.
Right.
Even though that one fellow from her past comes and offers to take her away from Downton Abbey. But, yeah, it could be somebody like that. But definitely not a troublemaker.
Okay, and earlier you mentioned Athena.
Yeah, so Athena, you know, like Condoleezza Rice, you don't hear much about her lovers, and she's considered a virgin goddess, and often can be an attorney, and she's weighing the scales of justice, and she can be, you know, extremely scholarly, you know, a thinking type, and trying to think what else, you know, might be a judge.
And you sort of end your book on the note of Sophia, which I gather was really important to you. So tell us a bit about Sophia.
Yeah, so Sophia is really the goddess of the all. And she, in some of the stories, was a whore and really, you know, sort of like Cinderella before the prince came and lived a very, very lowly life, you know, in the underworld. And then due to her suffering, you know, she really developed. And like in the Nag Hammadi Library, in Thunder, Perfect Mind, it talks about Sophia, and she's not a man, she's not a woman, she's not a virgin, she's not a whore. She's your brother, she's your sister. So she contains the all.
Somehow I associate the word wisdom with
Yes, I was just
going
to say that. Yeah, so she's, you know, the goddess of wisdom. So she would be, you know, one's highest value.
You've also got a chapter on alchemy as it relates to feminine development. Maybe you can take us through the high points of that.
Okay, I will. And I just wanted to say one other thing about the before I go there, before,
sure.
About the pure, you know, many of these feminine mythic types that I write about, many women, you know, are mixtures, and it's hard to tell really what type they are.
Sure.
And they're more fortunate. But for the pure Aphrodite type, it's very, very, you know, one is, in my opinion, born with these archetypal structures, and it's not necessarily environmental or what your mother did or what she didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
But for the pure Aphrodite type, it's very, very hard, if not almost impossible, to integrate other goddesses, I think. And then they're the ones, you know, who are more made fun of or can get, you know, on the edge of being ridiculous. So that's the toughest one.
Okay. Okay. Well, let's talk a bit about alchemy. And
okay.
Yeah, I know that I can identify with that. I feel like I write much better than I speak. And so.
Well, you speak beautifully.
Well, thank you. I would want to read from my book if the shoe were on the other foot, because, uh-huh. you know, because you have a chance to kind of really work it out and put it in the best possible way.
Thank you. Well, some people have told me that, because alchemy's, you know, Jung rediscovered it, and many Jungians have written about it, but I don't think from the standpoint of romance or, you know, falling in love. So in the book, I go through some of the different stages of alchemy. And like in figure two, it's when the couple first meet and their left hands touch. And the left-handed touch is like you're already entering sort of into darkness. And of course, that's where the chemistry is. And then in like the next picture, they're naked. And then in another picture, they're in a bath together. Of course, that's when they're naked and in a bath, and it looks actually just like a modern-day jacuzzi.
Yeah, some of those images from alchemy look like they might have invented the California hot tub long before.
And so then they're underneath the water together, and these different stages are very evident when one falls in love, which, you know, as I said, Aphrodite types do with great frequency, and each time thinking this is the one, and they enter, you know, this incredibly heavy duty sort of unconscious chemical connection, and generally it goes through a 6-week cycle, like in the Bible, 40 days and 40 nights. And then on the fifth week, the couple may have their first fight and break up. And then if it lasts the 40 days and 40 nights, you know, there may be a relationship for at least a while. And this isn't just with Aphrodite types, but with love affairs in general. And so if one knows some of these stages and the unconscious archetypal patterns that the psyche goes through, it just makes one more conscious and aware. So if that makes sense.
Yeah, and one of the things I really like about your book is that you share so much of your own struggles with the Aphrodite archetype, and you do talk about your growing up in Beverly Hills, which you describe as a very dark town, perhaps the darkest town. And the fact that you were a Hollywood actress in your younger years. And so you both had the opportunity to observe a lot of Aphrodites at close quarters. But you also went through your own struggles with your archetype as well. What can you share with us here about your own journey with Aphrodite?
I can find this one part here that I could read. As a young Aphrodite woman, I worked in Hollywood as a dancer, model, actor, and movie extra straight out of Central Casting. During my teens and 20s, I worked on hundreds of television shows and films, from Twist Around the Clock, surfing commercials, Viva Las Vegas, and Harem Scarum with Elvis, Ozzy and Harriet, Dr. Kildare, Ben Casey, and Love American Style. As a girl on the set, I was asked out by Elvis. I declined, knowing at the time that it was not a real date, but that I would be picked up by one of his Memphis hometown boys, flunky, gophers, bodyguards, friends of Elvis, and procurers of women. Elvis simply had sex with the young girls, and then the gopher would drive the girl home in one of Elvis's limos. I was also asked to pose nude for an issue of Playboy called Extras in Hollywood, which I also declined. Neither opportunity offered the kind of live limelight that my Aphrodite soul was fervently seeking in those days. Worse, as a mere extra and dancer, I was in the underbelly of usable, disposable Hollywood girls. Still, there was always the possibility of being recognized as a star, a lure whose power I felt until the emptiness of the pursuit engulfed me.
Yeah, wow, that's so evocative. And boy, I probably saw you in one of those things.
Yeah, very possible. Actually, on YouTube, I've been able to find myself in quite a few of these movies and TV shows.
Oh, fascinating.
It's sort of when I did my book lecture at the Jung Institute in L.A., we showed some of these images on the screen, one of them where I'm dancing in the background with Paul Revere and the Raiders. And so I was able to show in a very lively manner my hopeful transformation from a girl on the set to a Jungian analyst.
Yeah, really. That is remarkable. There must have been something, you know, something different about you, I would think, that, I mean, do you think you weren't a pure Aphrodite? What is it that saved you? At one point, I know you had a dream that was kind of the turning point for you, but what saved you, do you think?
I think actually what saved me, and I really was a pure type, and I think still pretty much I am, although obviously I've been integrated some other things, right? Wouldn't be talking to you right now. But it was really literature in my case. Mm-hmm. My father was an amateur Shakespearean authority, and just every night of his life, he would be reading Shakespeare before he went to bed. And he also painted very well. And so the highest values in the family were really literature and art and going to museums. And as a young girl on the set, I was also very introverted. So an extrovert, you know, might turn out very differently. So I would be sitting in a dark corner of the set reading Dostoevsky or Tolstoy. And also my introversion wanted to escape from, you know, all these, you know, men trying to come on to me all day long. And so it was really literature and just somehow a yearning that life had to be better than this, because I was pretty, pretty unhappy.
How did you find your way into seeing a Jungian therapist?
It was really, fate or luck. What happened was when I was about 24, I, you know, was convinced a psychiatrist would, of course, cure me. And it was really before the days of, you know, marriage counselors, and even from, you know, people who didn't even go to psychologists were really more involved in testing in that era. So I went to a psychiatrist, and he turned out to be a Freudian analyst. Someone I knew at the time gave me the referral. And really, I stayed with him for about a year, and it was also when a lot of analysts did group therapy. And I was in the group as well, and really nothing happened. And he really accused me of being like a brick wall. And interestingly, he's dead now. His name was Saver. Saver, S-A-V-E-R.
Huh.
But he didn't save me.
Yeah.
And he said I was like a brick wall. And during that time, he never, ever asked me about a dream. So I eventually quit and sort of had an argument a flirtatious thing with someone in the group. And so I eventually quit. And one of the women from the group called me and said, I have to tell you, you really need to see somebody. And so I called this former analyst for a referral, and someone in his office building in West L.A. was a Jungian analyst, and I don't think he even knew the man was a Jungian. I had never read Jung and never heard of Jung. And it just absolutely clicked. And within 6 months, I went back to school and knew I wanted, had to be a Jungian analyst. So it was really, you know, miraculous.
Yeah, and you share a dream that for you was kind of a major turning point. And I'm trying to remember, was it a Snow White or a Sleeping Beauty type dream you said that you had?
Yes. I can't quite remember the dream, but many dreams of some sort of man trying to save me. And I was like Sleeping Beauty, quite asleep. And so when this Jungian analyst, his name, he's also passed away as James Silber, said, you know, it's like a Sleeping Beauty, the whole kingdom's asleep, you're asleep, and you're waiting for the right man to come, you know, the right prince to save you, which for an Aphrodite type, they always think, as you pointed out earlier, that the next one is the prince, the good
mm-hmm.
one.
Mm-hmm.
But he explained that it was my animus, my inner man, that hopefully might save me. And I just, you know, I just couldn't believe it. It just, you know, absolutely clicked with me. And I think I, you know, went back to school, which at that point was Santa Monica City College, you know, within 6 months, and went on this, you know, journey of eventually getting a PhD in mythology, and before that actually becoming a Jungian analyst and being licensed, and, you know, so many of the things that you have gone through.
Yeah, yeah, what a journey. What a journey you've gone on, and also through very dark times. We don't have time to go into it, but you actually talk about how you talk about murder and how your brother and your father were actually murdered, and how that kind of fits into the whole kind of pattern that you were looking at. And you talk about tragic Aphrodite blondes, which I thought was interesting. I've certainly had that blonde hang up in my life. And you trace a number of their Hollywood careers and tragic early deaths. Maybe you can take us through a couple of those. You actually go through a lot of them. It's like you've made a study of it, right?
You know, a bit of a study. Marilyn Monroe, I think, how old was she when she died? 34 or something?
Wow.
And, of course, Jean Harlow, Princess Diana was blonde. But just something, you know, and then I talk about that to TV series about
a
girl.
A Dream of Jeannie? No?
No, actually, it's not that one. It'll come to me. But anyway, the girl in it comes to Hollywood, and the first thing she does is dye her hair blonde. But it's just something, I really don't know why blondes. I guess because Aphrodite was called the golden one. And I think, you know, there are probably statistically less blondes in the world than brunettes. But just something about that seems to go with the Aphrodite archetype.
And right now we're in such a blonde era. I finally had to retire from teaching, partly because when I say had to retire, I don't mean I was compelled by external forces to retire, but I was having trouble recognizing my students and telling one from another. I had all these blonde girls who come up from LA to go to Sonoma State University because it's sort of in the country, and so many blonde ponytailed girls, and they all looked alike to me. I couldn't remember their names.
Oh, that's so funny. So that actually was in part of your feeling of wanting to retire, that.
Yeah, partly.
That you couldn't differentiate.
Yeah.
One ponytail from the other.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned earlier, your book triggered a lot of reflection for me. The archetype that I think that was particularly active for much of my life is that of Pu'er. And so I'm wondering, what's the relationship of Pu'er and Aphrodite? Pu'er being the eternal boy, I guess.
Yeah, or like in popular culture, the Peter Pan complex.
Yeah.
But Aphrodite's generally go for Pu'er's, and they go for her. And there's a very because I think they're more permeable to love.
I might have thought that you mentioned Dionysus. I might have thought that Adonis would be the male countertype of Aphrodite, but somehow in my own case, Puer feels more apt.
Well, certainly, I think Adonis is an aspect of Dionysus. Uh-huh. But like Dionysus is the youngest god on Mount Olympus. So Puer's, even let's say they're in their 60s or 70s, they're sort of eternally, and Puella's the female counterpart, are eternally young inside. And the positive part is it can lead to great creativity. There's an aliveness. I think, you know, many analysts are Puer's.
Oh, that's good news.
Yeah.
And, well, just as the challenge for Aphrodite is to come to grips with aging, I think that's also very true of the Puer. I was in a Jungian workshop some years ago, and one of the things that we did was make masks. And so I made a mask that was molded to my face, but of course it didn't have any hair. And so I realized, and at the time I had plenty of hair. And somehow I recognize in that I believe Cynex is the archetype of the sort of wise old man, if you will, and that my challenge was to grow more in the Cynic's direction.
Yeah. So like the Puella Aphrodite type, to grow more in the, you know, in the direction of wisdom or the wise woman as she gets older, rather than being an imitation of youth.
The picture I got of the It girls you described was a beautiful but shallow woman. I had a particularly beautiful mother, which I know has marked my psyche pretty strongly. Just even in grade school, the other kids would remark about my mother's beauty. Oh, your mother's so beautiful, and blah blah blah. But she was also very bright, and so the women that I've been drawn to have had both beauty and substance.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's possible. I mean, just because someone's beautiful, they obviously don't have to be shallow or dumb.
Where does narcissism fit in here? We haven't talked about narcissism, but in many ways, Aphrodite sounds like Narcissus, fascinated with her own image and beauty.
Yes, it's true. Or trying to, you know, I think, you know, Aphrodite types get so much feedback for being beautiful or being the It girl or walking in a room, so that, you know, who wants to give that up? So
right.
There's a constant, you know, emphasis on, you know, more clothes, more shoes, more hair extensions, you know, as they get older, surgeries, whatever. So it just feeds on itself, you know. And for instance, when I talked about the Artemis type, I mean, all human beings are narcissistic, but it doesn't display itself, you know, in the realm of beauty.
What do you think's going on in our culture right now? I'm just aware that our culture is really stoking the fires of this sort of thing. I'm thinking of some of the reality shows that are out there right now, like Real Housewives of Atlanta,
right,
and Beverly Hills and elsewhere, and New Jersey, and America's Top Model. And it just seems like there are these different quotes reality shows that are throwing fuel on that narcissistic fire and helping to build that dream, if you will. What's your take on all that?
You know, I'm not exactly sure. You know, I suppose just because of the internet and the media that, you know, it's more accessible to everybody. The look, or how you're supposed to look, or whatever. But I'm not sure actually why it seems to be, you know, more prevalent now. You know, my guess is maybe it always was, but we weren't as aware of it.
Yeah, it's just now came to mind, and I'm thinking that there's some room for exploration there, that there's maybe something in the culture, there's some kind of aspect of shadow that's being denied, particularly right now, or I have a feeling it's part of some larger denial that's going on.
What do you think it is?
Well, you know, I'm just thinking off the top of my head right now, but the world is in such a tragic place in many ways, you know, politically, environmentally, that it feels like we're on the cusp of perhaps a major tragedy. And so it's got some feeling of the Roman circus of diversion and taking our attention away from the deeper things that we need to be attending to.
Yeah, that's a really good point about the Roman circus. I'm just thinking, I haven't seen it yet, and I don't know if I will, of this movie Hunger Games, that I guess is now the most popular movie ever.
Yeah, I did see it, and I'm reading the book right now.
Oh, you are? Maybe I'll just do that. But so I've been wanting to kind of see it because I like to see what's happening, you know, with contemporary culture, but I don't know if I can stand it. And, you know, about, you know, teenagers, what, killing each other. To the death, but I think that's part of the same thing.
I think you'll be able to stand it. I think that it's if you remember Lord of the Flies, mm-hmm. William Golding's book.
Yeah, of course, I love that, the book. And yeah. Movie.
So in a way, it's a rebirth of that notion, and it's not. You know, I'm probably jaded, but it's not. Horribly violent compared to a lot of the other things that are out there. Well, look, as we wind down, I'm wondering if there's anything that you'd like to add.
I think the only thing, and you asked about, you know, consciousness earlier, and that, you know, I really feel for those of us who are, you know, born really sometimes stuck with these particular archetypes, that really I feel only a deep analysis and dream work and really getting to the darker aspects of the personality can help. But just like, you know, a Band-Aid or, you know, goal-oriented or cognitive work, in my practice, people who come in from that really have not gotten to the depth issues. And, you know, journaling and writing down dreams, whether one is an analysis or not, really for the rest of one's life.
Yes, I heartily agree. I'm teaching a dream class right now and encouraging people to keep a dream journal. So I couldn't agree more. Dr. Arlene Diane Landau, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You are very welcome. It's been an honor and a pleasure. Hi, this is Dr. Arlene Diane Landau, Jungian analyst and author, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Arlene Diane Landau. I think it should have strong appeal to both women and men. Every woman has to struggle with accepting that moment in the aging process when she walks into a room and discovers that there is a dramatic absence of sexual interest from others that used to be there. It's a difficult moment, especially if she's been a woman blessed, or should I say cursed, with physical beauty. Many men will experience such a moment as well, though it will probably come later in life than for women, and may not be quite as dramatic. This book will help beautiful women understand themselves better, as well as the challenges that lie ahead and how to prepare for them. Men will find themselves reflecting on their relationship history, particularly with the beautiful women that they did or did not get involved with. And I think everyone will be interested in Dr. Landau's personal experiences in Beverly Hills and the Hollywood film industry, as well as her accounts of such tragic Aphrodites as Princess Di, Marilyn Monroe, Marilyn Chambers, Jean Mansfield, Grace Kelly, Jean Seberg, Rita Hayworth, Paris Hilton, and others. The book is a slim 100 pages, and yet contains much profound wisdom.
Dr. Dave would never ask you himself, but the show is growing, and so are his production expenses. Be a part of our podcast family and make a contribution to keep these informative and entertaining programs a-coming. The show must go on, and with your support it can. Just go to the website and click on the green donate button. Long live Shrink Wrap Radio and the listeners that support it.
Thanks, Mike West. Well, it's not quite true that I'd never ask for your support myself, because I have in the past. I do appreciate these promos, however, that let someone else do the asking for me. And I do want to thank all who've clicked on the big green donate button, and it's been quite a while since I publicly thanked ultra-colossal donors John Holmstead and Ashley Taggart, and super-colossal donors Katie Morrison and Peter Myron. And thanks to all the rest of you who have donated and who will help support the show in that way. I want to call your attention to the fact that there are now a bunch of new share buttons beneath each episode on the website. This thanks to a suggestion from listener Lisa Shalfoon. I hope I'm saying the last name correctly here, Lisa. I somehow didn't even realize this was something I could add, but I did find a number of WordPress plugins that could offer this sort of functionality. So now, if you go to the website, you'll find you can easily email a link to any given episode to your friends, and you'll also see buttons for sharing via your Facebook, Twitter, Google+, or LinkedIn social networks. So let the sharing begin! And thank you, Lisa, for that excellent suggestion. The one downside I see to this is I think more and more people are listening on mobile devices and maybe aren't going directly to the website. So let me encourage you, every now and then, go to the website so you can do something like that kind of sharing, commenting on shows, and of course, there's always the big green donate button. And speaking of suggestions, I got another one from listener Dr. Gabriela Gorsch, a psychotherapist living in Spain. And she wrote, "Hi, love your show. I just posted your website on my Facebook page." And her Facebook page is about her book, Rewiring the Soul. And she goes on, "And I wanted to tag your own Facebook page, but found I could not do so as it is a group page. Were it a regular business page as opposed to personal or group page, by tagging it, others who see it on my post could click on it and find information on your current and wonderfully downloadable archived shows, as opposed to leaving Facebook and having to go to your website. Just a suggestion. Best," and that's from Gabriela Korch. Again, a last name that I may have wrecked. She's in Marbella, Spain. Well, I don't fully understand all the ins and outs of Facebook, but I could tell Gabriela knows what she's talking about, so I went ahead and created a new Facebook page, a business page, I guess, and would love to have you all go and, quotes, like it. You'll find it at www.facebook.com/shrinkwrapradio. I love the shortness of that address. My other two Facebook pages, my personal one and my fan club one, they don't have an easy address like that. They have a lot of numbers after it. This one's great. Just facebook.com/shrinkwrapradio. So go like it, tag it, whatever else you want to do to it. And I do also have a Shrink Wrap Radio fan group page. And that one's, it's separate from this one that I just created. I need to put links to both, I guess, on the website, and I plan to do that quite soon.
Hi, this is Stuart L. Kaplan, MD, author and child and adolescent psychiatrist, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Dr. Stuart Kaplan, who will be my guest on the next episode. More about that in a bit. First, let's listen to some recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. First, we hear from one of my former teaching assistants, Michelle, who writes, "Hi, Dave. I just listened this AM to your recent discussion with Dr. Raff. It was so helpful to me. I have been kicking around a book idea for quite some time, but not really able to get an angle on it that worked. I loved the ordering principle idea about meaningful events organizing around individuation of the self through synchronistic happenings. So fascinating and enlivening for me intellectually, it inspires me to get to work on more writing in this area. Hope all things are going well. Congrats on the impending arrival of the new grandbaby. Take care. And that's from Michelle Glaubiger, M.A., who runs a service called Visionary Consulting. So good to hear from you, Michelle, and I'm glad to hear that you're listening to Shrink Wrap Radio, and I hope you hear this one too. And stay tuned, because I'm going to have some more interviews on synchronicity, and particularly there's going to be one with Joseph Cambray, who has written the most recent book on the topic and particularly goes into that whole business around the ordering principle. So stay tuned. Next, we hear from Travis with a great suggestion for us all to try. He writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. I've been working on training for lucid dreaming. So far, I have recorded my dreams in a journal, but this is from the help of having a timer go off in my earbuds every 90 minutes. And if I actually do wake up and have clarity of a dream, I grab the flashlight and script it down in a small notepad. Now I need to highlight the dream signs that are consistent within my dreams. Anyway, I thought of an idea for you to try. Since you have an iPhone, you might have an advantage over me. If possible, record an MP3 file of an introduction and narrative of something relevant in your past 2 days, and use rhetorical themes that have been a pattern in your current lifestyle. Perhaps it could go something like this. Quotes, David, are you dreaming now? If you are dreaming, be aware that I, David, am here to let you know that you are dreaming, and you can be aware that you can direct your dream. Do you want to go hiking? It sure is pleasant. It might be easier to fly to the pinnacle rather than the walk. It is fascinating, to just fly up there and see the view." Close quote. Have your recording launch via timer on your iPhone. You might want to have it in a front pocket of a t-shirt while sleeping, and make sure the earbuds do not get tangled as you sleep. Have the recording go off at 4:30 a.m. or towards the beginning of the peak REM part of the sleep cycle. Set the volume loud enough to wake you, but quiet enough to not startle you. Remain comfortable and lay still. Maybe, just maybe, you will hear the message as you induce the dream by telling yourself that you are becoming aware in your dream. Become lucid, then share your results on a podcast. I hope you will try this and let us know. If this works, perhaps the next level of psychotherapy can be inserted into a dream directly from a pre-recorded therapy session that can be absorbed in a dream. The results of the following day might show a reflection in revealing something new and profound. Exciting stuff. Best of luck." And that's from Travis Appel. I hope I'm saying that right. Might be Appel. Sculptor, designer, and psychology enthusiast. Well, that sounds like a great experiment, Travis. And I have to say, I'm way too set in my ways and more dedicated to a good night's sleep at this point than perhaps to science or even the exploration of lucid dreams. But I think this is a great experiment for listeners, for those of you who have the passion, the fire, the determination. Listen back to this instruction set that I just read and give it a try. And if it works for you, if you have something to report, please send me an email and I'll read it on the air, and Travis will get the feedback that he's seeking. I think it's a very interesting experiment that he's outlined for us. Now, here's one from longtime listener John Knight, posted in the comments area following my interview with Dreamworker Bob Haas in episode number 300 on the neuroscience of dreaming. And John writes, "Man, what a great one for number 300. I've actually been in the middle of a research paper for the last month and had to take several attempts at this episode to give it my full attention because there's so darn much to take in. Excellent resource, this one. I'll keep this one on reference for any psych friends." You know, and I have to agree with John about the richness of that episode, really full of a great take on the neuroscience of dreaming. And I incorporated a number of the ideas from that. I created a PowerPoint for a class I was teaching on lifelong learning about dream work. So I'm grateful to Bob Haas for all of that as well. And then John submitted another comment, this one on interview number 302 with Ruben Nyman on mindful dreaming. And John wrote, "Oh, amen. Now, this is my kind of guy." Along with number 300, this is another one I'll use for a reference point. So I, too, look forward to this being transcribed. I suffer badly from chronic fatigue and was fascinated by what I heard Ruben say, but I certainly want to hear more. If Ruben comes back as a guest, is there any chance of hearing more about dreaming, sleep, hyper-awareness, and fatigue? Then I'd be very grateful. I was so delighted to hear Ruben use the Copernicus analogy regarding consciousness and the unconscious, which is one I use all the time. I'm much like Freud and Jung in that the term subconscious greatly annoys me because of the sheer inaccuracy of the term and the misconceptions it creates. And I think this word in particular is doing a lot to shape people's thoughts that the psyche in general is consciousness-centric. And much like pre-Copernicus, with the Earth being at the center of the universe, the general public have been misled into thinking that you have this all-important consciousness with a smaller, fairly unimportant subconscious tacked on the back somewhere. When I introduce them to the idea that consciousness is relatively small and is something that grows out of a much larger unconscious, they are often very surprised and tell me that they've always had an idea of the psyche in reverse. Anyway, self-indulgence from moi. Great episode. I'm trawling through Dr. Nyman's website right now. John. I totally agree with you, John, and as I remarked at the end of that interview, I was just so taken with all of the very creative metaphors that Dr. Nyman comes up with. I'll definitely want to have him on the show again. As a matter of fact, he suggested a topic for a future interview. And I was listening back to that interview in the car with my son. And, you know, after these interviews are over, I forget a lot of it. And so when I listen back to an interview, I'm amazed at, you know, to hear all the great points, and particularly from someone like Dr. Nyman. And really, I should be taking notes, and a transcript would be so helpful. So I hope somebody jumps on that one. I can't remember if anybody's come forward for that one or not. Okay, I think that better wrap it up for today. As ever, you can send your emails to me to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments like John did about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on my phone at 206-337-0622. Better yet, you can invest in our iPhone and or Android smartphone app, and you can find a link to that under the Apps tab on our site. Thanks to Jungian analyst Dr. Arlene Diane Landau for sharing her work on the Aphrodite archetype. And as mentioned earlier, my next interview will feature a conversation with Stuart Kaplan, MD, and we'll be discussing his book, Your Child Does Not Have Bipolar Disorder. And you'll learn why he thinks that bipolar disorder is a diagnosis that should never be applied to children, despite an alarming trend in that direction. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.